This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Stay tuned for a Farm and Garden Show with J. Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor. Today we feature planting seeds and tending relationships through a visit with several partners at the seed farm at Princeton. First, some upcoming events. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to provide this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, that's 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Summer farmers market season is on. Copaic Hillsdale Farmers Market is at 9140 Route 22, Copaic, New York, through November 23rd, Saturdays, 9 to 1. Great Barrington Farmers Market is at 18 Church Street, Great Barrington, to November 9th, Saturdays, 9 to 1. Lee Farmers Market, 25 Park Place in front of the First Congregational Church in Lee, through October 12th. Lenox Farmers Market is at 134 Main Street in Lenox, through September 13th. Millerton Farmers Market is at Millerton Methodist Church, 6 Duchess Avenue, Millerton, New York, Saturdays through October 23rd. New Marlborough Farmers Market is at 134 Hartsfield, New Marlborough Road on the Green to September 1st. Sundays, 10 to 1. Otis Farmers Market, 2000 East Otis Road in the parking lot in front of Papa's Healthy Food and Fuel, East Otis, through October 12th. Saturdays, 9 to 1. Pittsfield Farmers Market on the Common, 101st Street, through October 12th, Saturdays, 9 to 1. Sheffield Farmers Market is at the First Congregational Church, 125 Main Street, through October 11th, Fridays, 3 to 6. Stockbridge Farmers Market is at Town Hall, 50 Main Street, Stockbridge, July 24th to August 28th, Wednesdays, 3 to 6 p.m. That's a new market. West Stockbridge Farmers Market is at the Foundry Green on Harris Street, West Stockbridge, through October 3rd, Thursdays 3 to 6. There's a Hazelnut Agroforestry Farm Tour, Saturday, July 13th, 2 to 5 p.m. at Nutwood Farm, 76 Porter Hill Road, Cummington, Mass. In today's Farm and Garden Show, we speak with people at the Seed Farm at Princeton. The Seed Farm sits on 3.5 acres of land, where they grow rare, culturally meaningful seed crops with community partners and pursue relevant research questions about the art and science of heirloom plants. Students, scholars, and community partners come together to learn from each other. Though they come together from a wide range of disciplines and life experiences, they share a common focus. The work deals with questions of repair and mutualism, including repairing relationships with land, soil, plants, the environment, and each other, and thinking about the essential role that mutualisms play in processes of repair. In their gardens, they grow plants for their seeds, which means tending them through lush green and peak fruit until pods have dried, fruits have browned, and seeds have matured. Each summer, Princeton students plant seeds from community partners and tend many relationships among plants and people that grow from the farm. During the academic year, students host work days, harvest and process the seeds, and continue to work with community partners on a variety of research projects. The work and research of the farm is shared at conferences in print and through social and multimedia platforms. A vibrant ecosystem of relationships makes their work possible. They are grateful for their collaborations with many generous people and organizations, including their community partners, the Experimental Farm Network, Muncie Three Sisters Medicinal Farm, Native Roots Farm Foundation, the Ujamaa Cooperative Farming Alliance, and the Utopian Seed Project. The farm is located at the Stony Ford Research Station, a center for local ecological research that is managed by the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton University. Jay and I visited the farm in late May 2024, and we spoke with, in order, Nate Kleinman, community partner from Experimental Farm Network, Tessa Desmond, project director, Kennedy, graduating senior in African American Studies, Katie, another student farm manager this coming year, Chow Lau, a postdoc at Princeton, Chris Smith from the Utopian Seed Project, and Gina Talt, project specialist. So we're at the Seed Farm at Princeton. It's very lush. It's been a wet year, and there was wet this morning.
and it's late May, so it's planting season. So I'm looking at a few plants here. Here's a key Charlem cucumber and Lanach Grex okra and a Shanay okra from Egypt. And one's from Burkina Faso, the other one, the first one. Taiz lentil from Yemen. Kenya white sunflower. Maycock squash, striped and yellow types. Grown near Blarney, Ireland. Ire. And the squash says Yakteen gourd, PHSL. Togo hoary basil. And Angola wild fenugreek.
Nate Kleiman met us when we first arrived at the farm.
So what do you have in your hand there?
I have got a flat with Ethiopian safflower.
Wow.
And a couple of sorghum seedlings, and then a big thing of sorghum seedlings. This one's from South Sudan, and these are two sorghum seeds that were in the bag of safflower seeds that
and
I got as food.
And I've got chickpeas, right?
You've got chickpeas. Those are very special chickpeas.
It says old seed.
Yeah, those are old seed. That's why the germination was poor, but luckily some of them sprouted. That's bred by a woman named Carol Deppy. Carol's awesome. And
I know of her from a friend did a radio show with her.
Yeah. So those are, she calls them Hannon pop beans, and she bred them from a bunch of different varieties she got from the USDA collection to be a chickpea that will pop when exposed to dry heat.
Wow.
You can pop them in a pan.
Oh, wow.
It's not exactly like popcorn.
There's a snack.
Generally, those have been boiled before they fry them. These can be cooked without any oil.
Wow. And I'm holding a flat of Palestine Rashad garden cress.
Yeah, that is some beautiful, spicy garden cress called Rashad in Arabic from the Palestine Heirloom Seed Library.
Hi.
I'm Tessa.
Hi, Tessa.
Nice to meet you, Bill and yep. Jay. Welcome to the farm.
Thank you. You work with seeds that are from war-torn areas that you're trying to save the seed? Keep
really from all over the place. We have long had a focus on seeds from communities under threat, whether by war
or anything.
Sea level rise or out-migration caused by poverty, all sorts of different things are affecting traditional farming communities around the world. The U.S. government has been getting seeds from around the world for 125 years or so at this point. We have in our government collections over 600,000 different varieties.
Wow.
And most of those came from other countries. So there's a lot of work to do to evaluate them and then ultimately return them to the communities where they came from. In many cases, many, many decades ago, and from communities that no longer have the same food culture that they had decades ago because of globalization.
And when you say we, you mean the Experimental Farm Network.
That's one of your focus. Yeah, Experimental Farm Network, that's been our major focus. I'm also working with the Ujamaa Cooperative Farming Alliance, which is another partner here at the seed farm. And so a lot of the plants that you'll find in the story garden here are ones that come from threatened communities, including from indigenous communities on this continent.
Tell us
as well.
About the Ujamaa.
Ujamaa is a cooperative started a few years ago in southern Maryland. Mm-hmm. It started with a small group of black farmers and pretty quickly expanded to include a really diverse group of farmers from around the country with the aim of bringing more equity to the seed industry in this country, which has largely been a white-led industry with white farmers getting the benefit from selling seeds that come from around the world. 90% of the food crops that we grow were not domesticated in Europe, have their roots in the global south. And so this is a long overdue effort to bring more equity to the seed industries.
And you mentioned indigenous people, that you have a project with indigenous people's seeds, is that right?
Yeah, we're working with multiple different Lenape organizations mm-hmm. from New Jersey and from Delaware. We're growing Lenape corn, we're growing Nanticoke squash, and a number of other crops.
Yeah, a wide variety of beans that hail from Lenape Hokang that were selected and bred here originally. So the Lenape Hokang plantings, we have two nice looking mounds here and then two that are in the flags that are now covered in grass. It was just how far our compost was going to stretch. But the seniors at the seed farm, Nate brought the Lenni Lenape blue pulling corn back to Lenape Hokang via a seed keeper, a Cherokee seed keeper in Kentucky. and shared it with the seed farm in our first year to grow it out to see if the corn had been crossed up with GMO corn when it was grown out in its first year in South Jersey. So we've now been growing this corn here for 3 years and really hoping to participate in a revitalization of this corn and other Lenape varieties back here in Lenape Hoking. And so we've been growing it. We've done some seed selecting with Lenape folks from the diaspora who are living in Wisconsin and Canada, and then have been planting out those seeds that were selected with that group when they were here for a symposium hosted by the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And this year, we're really excited to be partnering with Native Roots Farm Foundation on the Lenape Hoking plantings. And there's a garden in Delaware that is growing very similar varieties to share as food through their community networks. And we are growing those varieties here for seed to share the seed. In an effort, you know, we can grow and replenish silos full of seed, but if nobody loves those crops and if nobody's eating and wanting to grow those crops, then that seed doesn't matter. We haven't revitalized a variety unless people are using it.
Two questions for you, Tessa Desmond. One is, was there any GMO contamination? And the other is it a flower corn or flint corn? What kind of, how is this corn used?
Yeah, well, Nate, you're going to check my answer. Nate, I'll listen and fill in. Yeah. So
Community. There
wasn't. No, we inspected the corn visually, and you can see the difference in the kernels if it's crossed up, and it was pretty good. This is actually a sweet corn. So you've seen blue corn chips blue amasa is sometimes used. This is a sweet corn, so fresh eating corn for July. It is not blue when it's sweet. It is yellow, but as it goes to seed, it turns blue.
How long has this project been going on?
This is our third season.
That's wonderful.
Experimental Farm Network has existed a lot longer than that, but the seed farm, it's our third season.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of perennials in here at this point. We have a patch of, there's some perennial wheat in this weedy patch in the front here that are just going to seed now after their second winter, which is very exciting. And then in the very back, the only tall plants you see right before the fence, that's a plant called Sochan, which is the Cherokee word for cutleaf coneflower, a native Rudbeckia plant. Looks like a black-eyed Susan, only the eye part is kind of green on this one. It's a perennial vegetable.
It's a green vegetable.
It's delicious. It's good in salads. It's good.
Tell me again what it's called again.
Sochan. S-O-C-H-A-N.
Really, so it's not echinacea. It doesn't have that burny taste of echinacea.
No.
It's got nice flavor.
It's got a wonderful flavor. It's more reminiscent, if you've ever had that edible chrysanthemum from like a Chinese restaurant or Chinese
we
market.
We both love that.
It has a similar flavor to that, but unique. It's not quite the same, but it has that sort of green tea kind of flavor about it. And then the middle patch of weeds, that is some celery root from Kirkuk in northern Iraq. That's another seed that we got from the USDA collection. It was collected.
Now, celery root, is it celeriac or is it celery root?
Same thing.
Same thing.
Yes, celeriac, celery root is just another word for the same.
So popular.
Same plant. Yeah, and it's really delicious. I mean, in Europe, they sell juice from it.
It's so good.
They grow that much of it. But this one is really lovely. It's a landrace, which means there's some natural diversity to the population.
Right.
Well, so you can see this one has red tints on the stem, and this one over here has no red pigmentation at all. There's mugwort and other stuff here, but you can see pretty much where the flags are, from that flag in the corner to that flag there. There are probably about 20 celery plants going to seed here. We had a much bigger population. There was some predation in the fall, especially of the patch that we had over there, which is completely gone. But this patch is here, and it's enough that we're going to get a seed crop out of it. Of course, this is a biennial, so it needed to survive the winter in ground. It's nice that we have this deer fence up because
Celery is delicious.
Yeah, I think the deer were eating it.
Oh, so this fence went up after that.
The fence went up this winter. Wow. We had an electric fence around it, but we take it down in the winter. So I came here late in the winter and just built a makeshift fence with the electric fence, not plugged in, but just trying to make it so that it wasn't easy for any critters to get in. Groundhogs probably like it too.
This is a fancy fence, and I'm talking about, what are those? Are those 4x4s that I'm looking at, those posts?
The big ones are 4x4s.
4x4s.
I don't know what those
and
are.
And the fencing, is that hog? That's too big for hog fencing. What do
eight
you call
feet
that?
Tall.
It's 8 foot fence, yeah.
8 foot fence. It's really it's quite stunning.
Fence. Well,
the posts are black locusts, so oh, really durable.
Last 50 years.
Yeah. Great. Because you hate to put all that work into something that's going to rot in about 10 years or 5 years.
There's one thing I haven't brought up, but we probably should discuss. We might want to put chicken wire at the bottom around the whole thing.
Sure.
Yeah, I also have a very short electric fence.
I was just
going to
say, bunnies.
Little baby bunnies will be through that easily.
Bunnies even, will be happy
even
to
grown
have.
Ones.
And the groundhogs even.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Does it go into the ground a little bit? You probably have to go in a little bit into
the wire
ground.
Doesn't.
But it is very rocky. This soil is not as diggable as other locals' soils are.
And this is rockier than most. We're standing on, when we started the seed farm 3 years ago, there was nothing different about this land from the scrubby brush autumn olive multifloros. It was covered. This ridge where we are was the first garden because it was cleared. And it was cleared because when that new barn was built, they pushed all the fill up here. So we're on the fill land, which actually gives us a nice little perch.
And drainage too.
And drainage. And so I think all farms have their issues, right? So here we are on fill, but we have better drainage. There we're not on fill, but it's very wet. It's soupy down there. You'll see we just had this downpour and now the okra team is planting in soup essentially.
Oh, well, the okra will be very happy with that.
But overall, this was the first garden that we established. The first year it was the story garden only, but the university had helped us to get funding to clear the land.
Oh, wonderful.
And then the second year we built the hoop house, great hoop house.
We're talking about in width, what is that about?
It's 30 by 96.
Yeah, that's a great. Great looking structure.
And then beyond that, we plant in direct sort of field conditions. This story garden is where we grow the smaller accessions and the things that need more protection, especially now that the deer fence is up. Down in the lower field is where we grow the bigger projects. So down there, we're planting okra today with the Utopian Seed Project. We're planting 500 okra plants down there.
Fantastic.
Those are projects at scale. We're going to do an African polyculture planting with Ujamaa, and then Gina Tult, who's the farm manager, is working with Professor Dan Rubenstein on a Three Sisters planting.
Oh, great.
That's different from the Lenape Hocaine crops, but that is thinking about how plant mutualisms in the Three Sisters work, and that's another one that's at scale down at the bottom of the field.
And what squash varietals are you using?
The squash here will grow a summer squash and a winter squash that were both originated in Lenape Hocaine and bred by the Nanticoke people. So the summer squash is a Maycock summer squash. And the winter squash is called the Nanticoke. Both are landrace squashes. We grew the Nanticoke the first year of the seed farm. We grow the Maycock the second year. The seeds came from Nate at Experimental Farm Network.
I haven't seen nettles growing here yet. I'd like to because I love to eat nettles.
Sure, they're great.
Mostly mugwort in here.
So much mugwort. Well, if you have trouble sleeping, you know, stick that in your pillow.
Yeah. I even put a little in my smoothie sometimes just... I like the flavor.
I love the smell.
Just like a little sprig of it.
It's wonderful.
I recently learned that my sister-in-law sends my mother-in-law mugwort. My mother-in-law lives here. And she sends her dried Japanese mugwort for her tea. And I said, oh, honey, you got to stop sending that. We have plenty. Let me just dry it for her.
I know. It's so wonderful.
It'd be nice to use.
I actually make a bread out of the seeds of this.
Yes.
It's got a lot of fiber in it, so I don't use much of that. I mostly use hulled buckwheat that's been prepared.
Yeah,
but the dock seed, put a little dock seed in there, and it just gives it a little something.
Cool.
I have some seed that I planted that was pretty old. I'm not sure if it's going to sprout yet. They call it garden patience, and it's like a European patience dock that was really semi-domesticated as a crop, so it has a much more mild flavor to the leaves.
Yeah, these leaves are pretty intense.
Yeah, the curly dock like this, I don't care.
Bill says as he's eating.
But I like the patience dock. I'm hopeful that this Romanian garden patience will be interesting.
So before it goes to seed, it's a little sour, like almost like sorrel the first year. But now it's awful.
I wonder if we want to walk down Okra Team. Sure. Yeah. It's going to break in 10 minutes. And
absolutely.
So you can at least see what they're doing down there. And then we can walk back.
Say hello to them too.
Yeah.
Can I ask what your ancestries are? Do you resonate with what's going on in the garden? Does it feel like home on some level?
yes is the answer.
Sounded like it was sounding yes.
Yeah, my ancestry is pretty exclusively Eastern European Jewish. Some of my ancestors come from Ukraine. We're growing some crops from Ukraine this year.
Oh, wonderful.
Probably something from Odessa, where my great-grandparents came from. Oh. Yeah. It's
And Tessa?
Yeah, and so I grew up in southern rural Minnesota, and my grandparents had a farm until the 60s when their farm, you know, was subsumed by Land O'Lakes. So I grew up with lots of farming stories in farm country. So farming was a thing that I knew people did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Minnesota, so Land of Lakes.
My family were German immigrants, German, Polish, and Dutch immigrants in that area of Minnesota. And so my story is a little different in that part of this work is connecting with those farming roots and recognizing this is something that I love to do too, that really did skip my parents' generation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many young farmers who are thinking about what they missed out on and how close we were to losing some of these long time practices. I'm also from a place of intense trauma and hard history, especially around Native American rights to land. So we're, you know, I'm from the Minnesota River Valley that was the site of the Dakota War. I grew up in my small town and it was taught to me as a war called the Sioux Uprising. And then I've since, actually through NPR programs and being out in the bigger, wider world, learned that there's another side to that story.
Yes.
And so I was born in the town of Mankato, which is the site of the hanging of the Dakota 38 in response to war. It's still today the largest mass execution in American history. I started learning that history about the time that Nate brought the Lenape corn here. I had been working in ethnic studies and Native American studies and related fields across those areas for a long time and thinking about literature and its relationship with social change and imagining different possible paths through life. My PhD is in literature, and then I pivoted to do work on food and agriculture. A book called The Seed Keeper came out the same year we started the farm. It's by a woman named Diane Wilson in Minnesota. It's set in my hometown.
Oh.
And it's about the removal of the Dakota people from the Minnesota River Valley. It's about the Dakota War, and it's about the legacy in that region. It moves from the 1980s back to the 1860s, back up to the 1980s. And it was a really powerful book. And that fall, I was teaching a course called Land and Story in Native America. It was in the spring, actually. And we invited Diane Wilson to come and speak to the class. You can teach these things and you can think about them in cerebral ways, or you can learn about them and let them affect you. The seed farm, I didn't mean to start the seed farm, actually. It wasn't part of my master vision for my scholarly agenda. But I was working with community seed keepers, and one of the elders in Ujamaa, Bonita Adib, asked me to grow seeds with her. And then one of the elders in the tribal communities around here asked me to grow seeds with them in the same summer. And I had already been teaching a little bit on seeds in my courses. I taught a freshman seminar, and I knew students were really interested. And so I thought, I could do this. I have a small homestead farm that I live on, but I'm already maxed. I don't know if I'll be a good steward on my own. Mm. And so I brought it to Princeton, and I tapped a few folks who I knew were working in related areas, and everyone was very excited about the idea about starting a farm to grow seeds with these community partners. And so I went for it. And I've never seen things fall in line so quickly for a project in the university.
Yeah, wow.
It called you.
It did. And so I think it's all been a process. It's been a process about being open, not holding too tightly to my own agenda, being open to seeing where this project is going to go, clearing other things off my plate so we can do it, and then letting the strands that are coming together touch me and shape me and help me to think about, okay, so that's the Dakota War, the Homestead Acts of 1862. Those are part of my history. That's part of my upbringing. My father's family had a farm that they procured through the Homestead Acts. I was raised by my mom, and we grew up without much money, but there's still this legacy. My father's family actually was economically much more well off than my mother's family. And even just observing those historical facts, and then thinking about life has brought me here to New Jersey, which is Lenape Hoking, and so what can I do in my space and place to think about that history and to, you know, in my own little way, try to work to reverse some of the historical wrongs that are so well documented now. And so, yes, it's very much in my history.
Yes.
It's just in a different way.
What a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Your story is really, really inspiring.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you sharing that. I think when we all dig a place, we find our connection to this.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of anxiety about that.
Yes.
What am I going to find? Maybe I don't even want to ask. But knowing is better than not knowing. And if you leave yourself open and you're genuine and thoughtful and honestly reflexive and not defensive, right, we can find a way.
A number of the farms in our area where a lot of the listeners are for this show are in unceded Stockbridge Muncie mm-hmm. land. And a lot of the farms admit that on their website.
There's a lot of the land mm-hmm.
And we found some stone mounds on our property that I had started dismantling thinking that they were European. And I brought a historian and he said, no, I'm pretty sure what they are.
Your wife didn't say, don't touch them.
Yeah, and I put them back. I got to listen to her more. She's got a lot of wisdom.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're on Stockbridge Muncie territory because the Stockbridge Muncie is one of the
they're
tribes that was represented. Yeah, they're in Wisconsin.
But
they're part of the Lenape diaspora.
Yes.
Oh, they are.
And yeah. Oh, hold on 1 second.
Thank you so much. If you will want to talk to any students, these are our students.
Hi, students.
You're running away.
Hi.
But
yeah.
Kennedy has been involved in the farm.
Hi, Kennedy.
Not to put you on the spot.
Oh, no,
he's
it's
recording.
Okay. Yeah, it's
Kennedy
okay.
has been involved in the farm for over a year, and Katie is new on the farm, but she's going to be playing a really big role this year as the student farm manager.
Ooh,
team lead.
Wow.
We need to find your title.
Yeah.
And this is Bill and Jay, they're alums here for a reunion.
Ooh, okay.
And they have a radio program, they're farmers too, they have a radio program in Western
Mass.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we have to go soon.
Okay.
Yeah, just for your question.
So what brought you to the seed farm? And let's get your name.
Kennedy.
Kennedy, hi.
Yes, nice to meet you, yes. I'm a graduating senior in African American Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What brings you to this, or what really excites you about this project?
I started working on this project over a year ago, last summer. I was working with a few other interns on the Three Sisters projects. Our job was to try to understand the relationships between the Three Sisters. So it's a indigenous agricultural and oral history practice that the corn, beans, and squash, the Three Sisters, are planted together. And then there's some other sisters as well, like sunflower, who are also planted with them. And so our project was to understand the relationships between those different plants. The larger project of the seed farm has been, I think, a really rewarding opportunity for me to work with other students, with faculty, and with community members, and learning about the stories behind all of these different plants and their significance in, from the communities that they come from, and understanding the histories of how they've evolved and changed over the years. So.
Great. Well, thank you, Kennedy.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
You're graduating.
Thank you. Yes. Oh. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm Katie. I'm also a graduating senior in the history department. And I very late got interested in this, or I was always interested in seed farm, but I very lately got involved. And it was because I'm interested in how knowledge is produced and created, especially regarding the environment and like how we think about it and how that results and like, translates into maintaining the environment through agriculture. And so I came at it from like, a very historical lens and like trying to understand something that's very community-based rather than like, an organization of like scientists saying we'll do this experiment and like, to like produce papers, but rather more like, community-oriented and guided process. And so kind of looking at that is my focus.
Great.
Wow,
yeah.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Well, we don't want to keep you too
yeah.
from what you need to do,
yeah.
but we appreciate your time and
yeah.
also the energy that you put into this project.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me grab you quick.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, yes, nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
Right. Congratulations, Kennedy.
Thank you.
Stay in touch.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
We have a gentleman at the back of a beautiful truck who's got a flat of some kind of greenness.
Hi, I'm Chow.
Is that more okra? Chow?
Yeah.
Hi.
That's
oh, that's like yellowish.
Yeah.
Variegated so, okra.
Yeah, we
sort of.
Grew the seeds first in the lab and then let them germinate. And then we got seedling and then we transplant the seedling into the field.
And we are speaking to?
Chow Lau.
How do you do, Chow Lau?
I'm doing well. Yeah.
And are you at Princeton also?
Yeah, I'm a postdoc working in the K-12 chemical and biological engineering department. So.
And how is this informing your studies?
Yeah, so my PI, Jonathan Conway, collaborate with Tessa and Chris. So yeah, they have this project. They got funding from, I think, the Princeton University, and also I think they are trying to apply for a grant from USDA, and did this project last year, and then we got some results. So we are trying to breed those okras and try to find the okra with high oil content. Then we can get that seeds. That okra can be used in the future, so it can generate the high oil content, which can be edible, or we can use as a fuel, the bioenergy.
As a biofuel too.
Yeah, biofuel too. So
these have been grown in the lab. They're about to be planted today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. They'll be happy.
Yeah, they will be happy. They have more place to grow. Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Great. And you're planting these this afternoon?
Yeah, we have planted some, transplanted some seedlings in the field already. So.
Great.
Yeah.
I think the okra will be happy with the mud.
Yeah.
So which ones are the high oil ones, do you think?
All the seedlings were selected from last round.
Right.
We have the top 30. So we have top 30 selected from 1,500 okra plants.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so those are candidates. So we'll plant them this year and to see if the feature is stable or not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Good luck with that.
And things vary across the field. So how do you take that into account? There's so many variables when you're not doing something in a lab. You're growing it in the field.
So at the end, we will collect the okra, and then we let it dry, and we collect the seeds.
Right.
And then we use a machine called the MMR to determine the oil content.
Now, do you test the soil? Because the different soils may create different expression of the genetics of the plant. Is there soil testing going on, or do you mix them up so that they're kind of all growing in?
We assume the soil will not affect
the result. It looks pretty uniform, but that's just to the eye. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah.
And we also extract the DNA and then do the genomic study and try to identify the genes associated with the oil content.
Ah, yeah.
And let me ask you again, in case I didn't before, what were the origins of these seeds? Do we know?
Where did you start?
I think all of those seeds from USDA.
Okay.
The parent line. And then all the okras are from the USDA lines.
I love okra. That's why I have to bend your ear about
it's delicious. They can be like, used for different kind of
and
cooking.
And the idea of high oil okra?
Yeah.
I'm there.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, you can get some oil like from Tessa.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of this year, so.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to talk with you.
Yes, good to talk with you.
Yeah.
Next, Tessa and Nick were discussing Maypop or passion fruit.
The official northernmost population that the USDA recognizes is in Cumberland County in southern New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But even that one was no doubt brought by people.
Yeah.
Likely in prehistoric times.
We were told Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts, is going to be like Maryland in 2050.
Not even.
Yeah, it's going to be sooner.
Already, I mean, I think it's already like Maryland was 20 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
I need those.
Them all the time. This is from a company called Tingley.
We're talking about these rubber overshoes.
Yeah. I wear
rubber
sneakers
overshoes
underneath.
That,
I can wear whatever I want. I wear
Nate
boaters underneath.
And yeah, Nate has some.
Tingly, T-I-N-G-L-E-Y.
Get home and my toes hurt because they're
Bapping
up
this
against
is perfect.
The top.
It's like the perfect size. They come off easily.
Yeah.
They go on surprisingly easily. And they're really, really durable. The first pair of these I had, I wore them for years. I would wear them walking around in parking lots or walking around the city on a rainy day if I happened to be coming there straight from the farm. It was years before they started to rip a little bit.
Okay.
So I went online and I bought four pairs to last me the next 20 years.
Are they're not available or are they still available?
They're still available.
We're discussing rain gear shoes.
Stores that carry them keep closing, but then I went online and found the company.
Okay. And Tessa, what are your boots?
Oh, these are Bogs. Yeah, mm-hmm. So my sister-in-law sent them to me when we started the farm. I'm due for a new pair, too. They have a big hole, so when it rains, they just flood.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But you use them until you can't use them anymore.
And mine are the half price UGG rain boots that I got in Ukiah.
I was just out in Ukiah.
Oh, who'd you see?
California Organic Seed Summit.
Oh,
oh wow.
Yokeo Ranch.
Yokeo
yes,
Ranch.
Yes, that's the one.
Yes. Yeah.
Yokeo.
Yeah, it's like right next to the community
shout
college.
Out to Yokeo Ranch. Hello, folks.
It was lovely. So this is the perennial wheat patch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perennial wheat. That's a perennial wheat.
Oh, wow.
That's probably the most vigorous and impressive of the perennial wheat plants.
Wow.
This is one as well.
Now, is this West Jackson developed?
This is not from the Land Institute, although I am collaborating with them on some of their breeding projects. This was developed by a guy named Tim Peters, who was out in Oregon.
And this is a grass we're looking at.
This is perennial wheat. This is...
Oh, perennial wheat. Okay.
This is wheat that has been crossed at some point with a perennial relative, most likely Thinopyrum, intermediate wheatgrass, or another relative of that crested wheatgrass or something like that, and then back crossed with wheat to maintain the perenniality from the perennial parent, but to primarily look like and act like wheat as far as the seed. So
and
you can
it's
see,
standing about 3+ feet tall.
You can see this mm-hmm. is the flower about to emerge. It yes. looks like a row of wheat. That's another one there. So we probably had 40 or 50 plants the first year when we started this patch from mm-hmm. 3 different seed lots originally. And now in the third year, we probably have 20 surviving plants.
Yeah, it looks like a little one right here.
Yeah, there are. This is another one right here. Some of them are not thriving, but we're going to save the seeds from the ones that are doing really well, because these are the ones that are showing promise.
How long will they typically live?
There's no sort of typical from this. This is, you know, this is still very experimental.
Right.
I've had a plant from the same lot survive 5 years.
That's good.
With really no care.
So when it's harvested,
you just cut it at the bottom?
You cut it at the bottom. Do you leave a little bit of green feed the roots or no?
No, you don't even need to cut it. These
you can just
shoots
pick the...
will die.
Right.
The grain off, these stalks will all die, and then new vegetative growth will come from the base a few weeks later.
So it will winter over.
These wintered over very well.
Yeah, you're zone 7, though. It's a little warmer than our
7.
Listeners, but yeah.
Yeah. We had 3 different lots here from the same general population. We've been selling this through Experimental Farm Network as Tim Peters Perennial Wheat Grex, which is a word that comes from orchid breeding. Just means it's the Latin word for flock, Grex. And so this is like a flock of perennial wheats. Some of these were awned, meaning they had the spikes, which are is a really beneficial trait in a place where you have a lot of deer pressure. It looks like this one, at least, the first one that's about to flower here, is an awnless one. And I wonder if the awnless ones had better perenniality, which I'm hoping is not the case. I want there to be at least a couple of awned plants, because I'd like to select and eventually have a fully awned perennial wheat population, so that especially for small farmers can be grown and they don't have to worry about the deer. You know, imagine something that you just plant in the ground and it comes back year after year for 5-10 years before weeds take over and you have to till it under. But you can see the tillering happening on this one. There's probably 30 stalks that are going to produce a head from this plant alone, and another one there, and maybe a couple of other nice healthy plants here. This is probably the most exciting planting we have at the farm, from my perspective anyway. We started Experimental Farm Network with the goal of developing perennial crops for climate change mitigation, because the less we have to till the ground, the more carbon we can sequester underground. Here, this one is awned.
Oh, good.
The plant is not super impressive. It has 3 flower spikes.
You don't pull the weeds out because you're letting them vent, or you pull some?
But only because it's such a wet day.
Yeah, and it's easy.
Oh, right, of course.
I don't want to mess with them, especially while they're going to seed like this. Here's another awned one. So it seems the awned ones are less vigorous. Oh, this one. You can see those awns. So that...
Oh, these little spikies.
That prevents the deer from eating it, because those are really irritating.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But when they don't have an awn, the deer have no problem with them. So that one's awnless, and this one has not revealed itself yet. I don't want to pressure it. I'm hoping that this one has some.
So tell me, Nate, who are the beneficiaries of the seed bank? Who's getting the products that you're saving?
The way the seed farm works here, the community partners maintain control of the seeds that are grown here. So we grow the seeds with the help of Princeton and the interns during the summer. We harvest them with their help in the fall, and then we get the seeds to do with what we will. So we're growing some seeds here just for increase, for regeneration purposes. Some of the seeds are purely for research, and then many of them we sell. We sell other seeds every winter. That's how we fund our nonprofit work. So
fantastic.
So people can order them.
How would people contact you in order to get that?
They can visit www.efnseeds.com. It stands for Experimental Farm Network. If you just Google that, you'll find us as well. We're on Instagram, and that's when we announce the catalog launch every January. At this point, we have over 550 different varieties in the catalog, and a lot of it are things that you can't get from any other seed company.
Fantastic.
I know you'll be looking for okra.
I know I'll be looking for a lot of
We have a bunch of okras. We have 15 different varieties of sorghum this year. Lots and lots of really interesting plants.
Oh, great.
And two perennial wheats. Oh, my favorites. That's really hard. But
right?
I am excited about some of the stuff from Odessa that we've been offering because that's where I have this ancestral connection to. One is a nigella black seed, really a wonderful medicinal culinary plant from the Middle East originally. But this was one collected in Odessa. Also a calendula. That's another beautiful land race. Real, a lot of diversity to the flowers. And then a melon and a sunflower from Odessa as well.
Tell me about the black seed.
Black seed, it's also known as, I mean, the Latin name is Nigella sativa.
Love in a mist?
Love in a mist is Nigella damascena. It's the prettier relative.
Yeah.
Though black seed is perfectly beautiful. Love in a mist has really been cultivated primarily as an ornamental. Black seed has a very strong flavor. It's also called kalonji seeds. Sometimes it's called black cumin, although there's other things called black cumin as well, and it's not in the cumin or carrot family. Nigella sativa, the oil, is super medicinal. It's used for a range of ailments. People take it every day as a tonic as well. The seeds, you most likely, if you're familiar with them, you've encountered them in cheese, like Armenian string cheese, that braided string cheese. Mm-hmm. It has those black seeds studded throughout it. That's a black seed, a black cumin, kalonji, however you want to call it. It's a really wonderful plant, and it took me a couple years to figure out how to grow it. It wants to be planted early, and I was planting it too late, but they're really, really lovely plants. Here, it probably wants to be started in March or April. The ones that volunteered where I grew it last year are already like 6 inches tall, and they're doing pretty well.
How do you think it would do in zone 5B, which is what the Berkshires are?
I think it would do just fine.
Well,
yeah.
Odessa's not freezing cold, but it's colder than here, I think.
I'm not sure exactly what, and this was collected in the 80s, so we have to look at the weather in Odessa in the 80s to see what it was adapted to.
Yeah.
According to a web search, it looks like Odessa is zone 7, similar to central New Jersey. Even in the 1980s, it was zone 7.
Are any of your ancestors alive that were from that region?
No. It was my grandmother, my mother's mother, was probably conceived there and then born in Buffalo. Her parents emigrated when they were pregnant with her. So that was 1905. My grandmother is no longer with us since 1990 or so. Her oldest daughter is my Aunt Ellen, who's in her 80s and is still with us. But that's the closest direct connection that I have to Odessa. It's a place I've never been, but would really love to visit. It has such an amazing history, and you know, obviously with the war in Ukraine, not something I'm going to be doing anytime soon, but one day I will get there.
But I have, you know, the Polish, I have the Romanian, the Russian, and everything else going on in that region, and I too am very curious to see.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to Poland, but I haven't been to a lot of the other places.
Yeah, I have Romanian ancestry as well, and I'd like to go there. One of these days.
Yes.
Make our way there.
Yeah.
Jay's sister gave us a Red Love apple, which I think is from Transylvania, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a red flesh.
Wow.
We haven't seen it yet because the tree is only about, what, this four
and the,
feet,
five and the
feet?
Wood is red inside. I was grafting it yesterday. And it had red wood, Red Love.
So
anyway,
if it shows up, we'll get you some grafting of that.
Yeah.
Chris, are you up to saying a couple of words?
Yeah, my name is Chris Smith.
Hi, Chris Smith.
Today we are planting out about 500 plants of okra, which all come from some high oilseed crosses, which we're trying to improve the oilseed content of okra. Mm-hmm. So this is part of that ongoing breeding project.
Great. And are you with an organization?
Yeah, I run a small nonprofit called the Utopian Seed Project. Based outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I flew up here yesterday. Yeah, this is the second year partnering with Princeton, and they've really made this project happen.
How long will you be up here?
I'm only going to be up here till Friday, so that's 3 days total.
Oh, okay. So you're just doing here for the planting, really?
Yeah. Last year and then this year, we've planned it out that I've come up for 3 short trips throughout the growing season, mm-hmm. just to help students kind of understand the scope of the project and then the key moments in terms of planting, some flower pollination stuff, and then some harvest at the end of the season. Mm-hmm.
So when you pollinate, do you have to bag the flowers or?
Yeah, it's actually, the plants will pollinate without any help from us at all. So the bagging is to prevent cross-pollination. So that's aiming to stop bees sharing pollen from one plant to another.
Right.
So we can keep those genetics pure.
But then you let some crossing happen to see what you get, right?
In this specific situation, no. Everything we want is going to be from bagged flowers so that we get pure seeds.
Right.
There will be cross-pollination that happens, but we're not interested in the results of that.
Uh-huh.
There's other projects we do where cross-pollination is all about it, but in this specific situation, we don't want the crossing to happen.
So you're just testing these varieties, right?
Kind of. This is the attempt to create a new variety.
Right.
So 3 years ago...
So you do deliberate crosses here?
We did deliberate crosses 3 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And then these are the children of those crosses.
So you're trying to keep the children the same?
When you do that cross, you shake up all those genetics.
Right.
And then the children have a whole mix of those genetics. So we're trying to find out which children are doing what we want, which is high oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we find those children, we keep them bagged so that they stay high oil. We call it stabilization. So we do an initial cross. We evaluate, which is why the Princeton partnership is so great, and then we stabilize them over about 5 generations.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in that kind of like analysis and stabilization phase.
Yeah, they'll just self-pollinate.
Yeah.
It's not even crossing between the
No, we're really lucky with okra that it has a perfect flower, so it's got both male and female in the flower. So
right, so you can just keep
just
it.
Bag it, and then it self-pollinates in the bag, and that's the stabilization process.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty easy to work with okra. It's a nice big flower. And it self-pollinates, so we don't have too many challenges in terms
of that.
Sorry
for the simplistic question, but so then if somebody took one of those varieties, they would plant that as the only okra that they grew, so they wouldn't have to worry about...
Correct, yeah.
Once it's stabilized, it can cross a little bit, but it's going to stay pretty close.
Yeah, that's where we are. Once the genetics have stopped, we say segregating, once they've stopped moving around, then you can have a whole field of that variety, and within that, they can openly pollinate.
Right.
And continue to be stable.
Now, is there enough diversity in that? Because there's something called inbreeding depression that happens over time.
For
so sure. Do you have to replenish that strain?
It's a good question. Like the project I work for, the Utopian Seed Project, is very much about maintaining biodiversity. So we lean towards having more diversity and less stability. Some varieties go the other direction where they're like hyper uniform.
Yeah.
And there's not very much diversity. So you might have more concerns in those populations. In terms of okra, because it does naturally get insect pollinated, if you've got at least 10 plants in the field, then you shouldn't worry too much about inbreeding.
Oh, I see, because there is going to be enough.
There'll be enough inherent diversity within that population.
Yeah.
If you just grow one plant every single year and save seeds and grow seeds from that one plant,
then
you'll have a decline.
Yeah.
But with okra, you should be fine with a garden-sized plot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just interviewed the author of Landrace Gardening, Joseph Lofthouse.
Oh, yeah. Joseph Lofthouse's and our philosophies around diversity are very aligned.
The Utopian Seed Project?
The Utopian Seed Project, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of like maintaining those real broad genetic bases and having adaptive capacity within the populations, we're definitely on board with that.
And do you sell seed also?
We sell a little bit of seed through seed companies, so like the Experimental Farm Network, Ujamaa Seeds, Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, they carry some of our seeds. Yeah, we're in the mountains, so we're a little bit cooler than the rest of the South, but it's still, Zone 7 is pretty safe.
So similar to here, actually.
It's one of the reasons why the Princeton partnerships worked out so well, is because from a summer climate perspective, then similar temperatures, similar humidity, so the plants are experiencing conditions that we want them to eventually grow in.
Yeah. And they don't mind being planted in mud, I guess.
Well, it's not the most ideal planting situation. Okra is very tolerant of wet feet. So
that's good.
There's some things that I wouldn't transplant like this, but okra will just It'll do just fine. Mm-hmm. I founded the Utopian Seed Project. Okay. So I began it, and I really started that project because I saw a need in our own kind of macro regional food system to have more crop trialing, seed selection, seed diversity, general agrobiodiversity within that system was lacking. So we started the Utopian Seed Project to be research, education, kind of promotion and celebration of all those things to get more farmers growing different things and more chefs, consumers, added value food businesses experiencing them. So just trying to do that systems level shift.
Well, thank you.
No worries.
Gina?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the directions.
Yeah, no problem. Nice to meet.
Gina Talt. And what's your role with the project?
I support programming and farm logistics. So helping with the coordination so that the research can go as smooth as possible. So, you know, Tessa and the community partners all have to think about, okay, like how do we till up the bed for planting, work with our facilities partners back at the universities or contractors. So yeah, it's provide that coordinating from both the like student programming, but also just operations.
Right. So you're with the university.
Yes. I'm a staff member in the Office of Sustainability. That's where I'm primarily based, but Tessa buys out some of my time and I help support the seed farm. I'm pretty much interested in supporting food systems work on campus. My major role is running a demonstration scale composting system on campus called the Scrap Lab. I am actually in a part-time master's program at Rutgers in a master's of business and science. So the science part, I'm actually concentrating in agriculture because my degree at Princeton was economics. So I don't really have as much of the soil science and agroecology background as I wanted. And getting a lot of professional experience here helps, but I wanted to get some of the foundational concepts of soil cycling in plants and how to read a fertility report, what cover crops will help address which challenges on a farm, things like that.
So I'm looking at some metal fence in areas.
Electric fence.
What's being grown in there? Do you know?
So this is a separate research project run by Dr. Andrea Graham at the university. She's also the faculty director of Stony Ford. It's ultimately this whole 99-acre property, most of which is forested. This is only, this clear space is only a fraction of the whole property. It was gifted to the university, I believe, by a family. Actually, there's a nice little plaque up here we could take a look at. I believe it was in memory of their son who tragically passed away but was a Princeton student. And they wanted the stipulation around the grant was that it be used for ecological research. So it's technically owned or managed by the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, EEB, department on campus. This is part of the trail system, and there's a groundskeeper, his name is Billy, and Billy's really great, and he helps maintain these trails, because that was also part of the ask of the grant, was that you'd be able to walk in the forest. So I think this was back in like the 60s or 70s. And over the years, it's been used for faculty research. In 1967, the
mice. Margaret and Millard Mice, M-E-I-S-S, in memory of their son, Michael. Stony Ford Center for Ecological Studies at Princeton University. Oh, yeah, we met Katie earlier. Yeah. You've got a big community, a lot of different people and groups and in this project.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes this project run, is really, Tessa's very scrappy building a community to help me run the farm, because it helps to have diversity of people, because sometimes some people won't be available other times. So if you have a large pool of willing and interested students, especially, as much as possible, try to gain Princeton students. It's the best. But this is year three of the project, year two of really in this expanded plot. The first year we were just up at the Story Garden, and we're just trying to figure out what model works best for the yearly operations. We love to partner and pay local farmers to help us with some of the bigger tasks, like the initial disking and tilling of the field and seeding cover crops in the fall, but also what would make it easier for us to be a little bit more nimble and on the fly, and like what type of equipment do we need here. So we're trying to weigh options. We've been relying on electric fence mostly for deer control. Unfortunately, last year in that period where not as many people were here because we're very much revolving around the academic calendar, So there's going to be times like right now or like mid, late August where students are done for internships, but they're not necessarily back on campus yet. And you know, everyone just has limited time. And the deer broke into that story garden and ate some of our rarer crops. So we're like, okay, for that plot, it makes sense to
put a fence.
Yeah. So yeah, we're learning as we go.
It's all learning.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the best way.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you'd like to say?
No, I'm glad we got to touch base on the history of this land. I feel like there's so much more too that some of the older faculty know about, but there is a book inside the house. Yeah, with
I'll have a look.
Photos over the years. And there used to be that there was a house right here. Unfortunately, it caught fire just like a month or two ago.
Oh, wow.
But a faculty member used to live there. His name was Henry Horn, and you'll see in that picture him pulling his sons in that cart over there.
Aww.
So yeah, there's a lot of like, I guess, institutional history, but also like even before that, before colonists even arrived, it must have been an important place for Native communities. We think that there's a tree, I don't know if Tessa mentioned it, that's a directional tree that Native Americans have used to identify where's water and train the tree to grow a certain way to mark
that
where you are. It must have got damaged at one of the storms, but she has a project, Tessa, to try to do some archival work and understand the history.
And which tree is it?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Oh, it's a stump. So.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be taller just literally a couple months ago. It split. This one right here, this white one.
The white one, yeah.
It's this low one here. You can see how it fell apart. But it used to be a little bit taller, but you can see how it like was bent pretty much 90 degrees, so that makes us think that there was some human involvement.
Yep.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, trees do grow to try to access sunlight as well, but I think they want to actually look at the tree rings. And
so was it a chestnut, or because not much would last that long?
Yeah, that's a good question. Tessa would know for sure.
Yeah.
If it was an ash or oak, maybe maple.
What other projects go on at Stony Ford?
Right now, it's us. And then Andrew Graham's group that's they're looking at mice and what happens when you rewild them.
Environment.princeton.edu, that's the back of your shirt.
Oh yeah, so just changed names. It used to be PEI, Princeton Environmental Institute. Now it's High Meadows, because it's got a donor now. High Meadows Environmental Institute, but yes.
25 years at Stony Ford, from 92, so it started in 67. Oh,
wow. Yeah, so that's...
Yeah, we saw that on the sign. Oh, is that the house that burned?
Oh,
wow, that's a nice
It's still house. Technically up.
And what caused the fire?
We think that the tree that went down, you'll see a tree sycamore near the gate that must have hit the power line, and I think the power was still on in the house.
What I'm just going to do is take a couple of snaps.
And we can talk about it later.
Yeah.
The Stony Ford Field Station for Ecological Research has a book compiled in 1992 that we saw there. One of the research projects was feeding stations to test bees' communication of the distance of food from the hive. Summer 1976. Every summer for about 20 years, Professor James Gould and his students have studied orientation, discrimination, communication, learning, and instinct in the bees of Stony Ford. The results are summarized in a book by James and Carol Gould, The Honey Bee, Scientific American Library. A large number of research projects have started with casual observations from the dining room windows by Professor Henry Horn. For her doctoral dissertation in 1979, Catherine Schneider studied the preference of white-throated sparrows to forage near cover and how interactions among them and the spatial dispersion of food. Between 1975 and 1992, a dozen undergraduates have written senior theses based on observations of winter flocks of foraging birds at Stony Ford. Most of these projects explore the complex interplay among foraging efficiency, vigilance for predators, social interactions, and environmental conditions.
Oh, look at the images. Beautiful.
Remnants of the like what it looks like now, but also like 45 years ago, like when you graduated.
Wow.
Yeah, so look, that the house was so nice, and now it's like all wrecked. Yeah. But it was good
until the fire. It was okay,
it was dilapidated. So actually, in some ways, the rainbow behind it is that we could take it down and maybe build something, build back better. Because otherwise, the university was kind of just sitting on it. I think this is gonna cause them to take it down. Yeah. So here's a little bit of research. The mention of Henry Horne, who was a faculty, who just actually
Professor Henry Horne.
2019. So it's called Stony Four because it's a confluence of the Cleveland Brook and the Stony Brook.
Thank you, all of you, for your wonderful generosity with your time.
Thanks for visiting us.
Yeah.
This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also donate to support this community resource.